This week, the state of North Carolina sued the federal government to preserve its controversial bathroom bill. Hours later, the Justice Department filed its own civil rights lawsuit. Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Rachel Caulfield of Drake University and Stephen Schmidt of Iowa State University join us this hour to survey some of the latest issues on our political landscape. We'll also get their comments on the latest primary results and where this leaves the Democratic Party's nomination race. Also, how Donald Trump has split the GOP as he marches toward the Republican nomination, and why Iowa's Joni Ernst is being touted as a Trump vice president candidate. Join our discussion. First, this news. It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Delighted to have with us as our political analyst on this Politics Wednesday, Rachel Caulfield, associate professor in the Department of Political Science, also associate director of the Harkin Institute for Public Policy and Citizen Engagement at Drake University. Rachel, welcome back to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And a nice welcome to Stephen Schmidt as well in our Ames studio, university professor of political science at Iowa State University. Always glad to have you, Stephen.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
A little later in the hour, of course, this is an hour when we chew over things, recent happenings on the political landscape in Iowa and across the country. Later in the hour, we'll talk about Joni Ernst being touted as a vice presidential candidate. Also, the fight for the soul of the Republican Party. There's this big meeting coming up tomorrow between House Speaker Paul Ryan and Donald Trump. We'll talk about that, of course, the latest primaries as well. But first, let's talk about an issue that's popped up within the last couple of weeks. The state of North Carolina has sued the federal government to preserve its controversial bathroom bill. This led the U.S. Justice Department to file its own civil rights lawsuit against North Carolina. The widely criticized legislation passed in March. It bars individuals from using public bathrooms that do not correspond to their biological sex or the sex on their birth certificate. Let's hear from two sides. So here, North Carolina Governor Pat McCrory.
I do not agree with their interpretation of federal law. That is why this morning I have asked a federal court to clarify what the law actually is. Now, I anticipate our own legislature, other private sector entities from throughout the United States, and possibly other states to join us in seeking this clarification to our national anti-discrimination provisions under Title VII and Title IX.
Okay. Hours later, the U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch announcing the Department of Justice's civil rights lawsuit over North Carolina's bathroom bill.
What we must never do is turn on our neighbors, our family members, our fellow Americans for something that they cannot control and deny what makes them human. And this is why none of us can stand by when a state enters the business of legislating identity and insists that a person pretend to be something or someone that they are not.
Okay, we want to have you join our discussion here as we discuss this, mostly the first few minutes here. So if you have an opinion in here, give us a call, 1-866-780-9100. Are you in favor of bathroom bills like the one North Carolina is defending that restrict where transgender people can use the bathroom? 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Stephen, let me start with you. How has this issue become the latest, let's just say, culture wars battle?
Well, you know, it is one of a whole series of issues in which Americans are divided. And yes, there are majorities in many surveys and so on in favor of this or that or the other. But it is still a country very deeply divided, and it's obviously a high-intensity issue. And so I think this is fine, the way this is rolling out. I think we solve almost everything in this country with lawsuits, right? I mean, that's the We're lucky. You know, we don't get guns and go out and kill each other. That's how it's done in other countries. Here, we sue each other. The federal government sues the states sue the federal government, individuals sue states. And in the end, it will probably be resolved through court cases. And, you know, it may be a good thing if it is a federal case rather than simply, you know, a North Carolina case. In other words, a policy that might become a national policy as opposed to just a disagreement over legislation, even not even in the state, well, in the state, but mostly in a city in North Carolina. So I think this is a healthy way to do this. And we're having a great discussion about the issues that surround this, which is also very helpful.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, is it correct to say, Rachel, at issue here is just the question whether transgender people deserve the same federal protections that have been extended to groups such as blacks and religious minorities? Is that the crux of it?
I think that's the crux of it, certainly in the minds in the mind of the Attorney General, and in the minds of several others who are activists opposing the law. And it's a fundamental. It is an identity question. There's no doubt about that. It's taking place in a state where we have a good number of social conservatives, and as a result, it has sparked a very important. A very important debate in the middle of a political cycle that has already been fairly contentious. And so I think when you put all those things together, that's why we've seen it really take off.
Mm-hmm. CNN, there have been, I think, several polls on this. Here's a CNN ORC poll released on Monday, finding majority of Americans, 57%, don't agree with bathroom bills like the North Carolina one. As usual in contentious issues, you mentioned this, Stefan, there's a partisan trend here. So when it's broken down according to party politics, people tend to agree with their political leaders. On this, 62% of Democrats oppose a North Carolina-like bill for bathrooms. 58% of independents, and down further to 48% of Republicans who would oppose such a bill. But still, we're seeing, Stefan, almost half of Republicans opposed to laws that require transgender people to use the bathroom on that it corresponds with their birth certificate. So this would seem to be good news for transgender advocates that even those most in favor of it are still split.
Well, yeah, I mean, we are split as a country. And, you know, in part, it's an infrastructure issue as well, because, you know, we have in almost any organization, institution, or on things like airplanes and so on. Well, on airplanes, actually, it's much better, because on airplanes, you know, there it says lavatory.
Right.
We don't use that on Earth, but we use it when we're up in the sky. You know, if everything was a lavatory, there wouldn't be any discussion, because then you would go in and it doesn't matter who you are, what you look like, what you think you are,
right,
how you feel. And you know, we just have a long history of having pictures of someone who vaguely looks like a male and someone who vaguely looks like a woman with a dress. That's the only way you can usually tell the difference. And if you're looking at the icon, and they say, you know, men and women, and so it's part of a culture. It's part of how we've defined gender and so on. And now that we're moving into new areas, as with everything else, including gay marriage, laws have to be fixed. Infrastructure has to be fixed. I mean, just think here at Iowa State University, you know, every single restroom is either women or men, with a couple of exceptions. We have a few family ones, you know, where they have a changing table and stuff. And so the question is, how do we manage this? Do we allow people to use restrooms regardless of their physical gender based on how they identify themselves? Or do we build infrastructure to accommodate people besides men and women? And it's not going to be easy. It's going to be,
right.
And it's not going to be just in North Carolina. You know, this fight is going to go on in other places. It is an issue of federalism in part. It's an issue of civil rights in part. And so it's just extremely complicated. And yes, it's going to be, I think, a part of what drives voters to the polling places in November, and probably already has driven them there in the primaries and maybe caucuses.
As a programming note, tomorrow we'll be looking at this minus the politics. By that, I mean we're going to be having some transgender guests, also researchers at the forefront of understanding how transgender and gender expresses itself. That's tomorrow, Thursday, on this program. Today, looking at it through the lens of national politics here, let's go to our phones. Jonathan is in Des Moines. What issue do you want to raise, Jonathan?
Hi there. I'm mostly interested in, as the law is written, as I understand it, someone who is born female but who identifies male and dresses male should use the woman's restroom. And what I don't understand is, if that's the case, that's going to cause a lot more consternation and confusion and issues if someone who is dressing and appearing as a man walks into the woman's bathroom. That's going to cause issues, just as if I, as a man, you know, a woman walked into the restroom. And a lot of the language, like the Duck Dynasty guy yesterday had a bit about how, you know, his little girl's going to be in the bathroom, he's worried about it. A lot of the language is really sexist about it, but I can't help but think that that little girl is going to be more freaked out by an adult man walking into the woman's restroom than, you know, another woman.
Right. Jonathan, it's all about appearances there. And this is complicated. Rachel, I mean, do you have a reaction to Jonathan's comment?
Well, I think what Jonathan is bringing up is one of the cultural issues here. And one of the cultural issues here is, are we essentially introducing the idea of policing gender? And what does that mean? Do we police gender according to biological sex at birth? Do we police gender according to the way, you know, according to outward appearance? And if we're policing gender in restrooms, where else are we policing gender? And I think that, you know, it adds a new dimension onto this cultural issue when we start talking about enforcing this law and we start talking about how it's going to play out in real life.
Yeah.
And that makes it, I think, more contentious. There's an unwritten and sometimes unspoken fear that we have about predatory behavior that's linked to gender. And that's something that I think we're trying to, you know, to reconcile on a very public stage right now.
Well, one of the questions that people have asked me, and I don't know the answer to this, maybe you do, is have there been incidents where someone went into a bathroom, the people there called the police and there was a confrontation or something, or is this a hypothetical? You know, how many times? I mean, if someone walks into a bathroom and looks like a man and it's the men's room, and they, you know, go use the sit-down toilet, I don't ask people who come in. There are a lot of weird people in bathrooms, right? And I don't ask them, you know, are you a predator? Are you a woman? Are you a man? What's the deal here? You go, you do your business, you leave. And so Donald Trump had an interesting answer when they asked him. He said, I would just leave it the way it is. You know, it hasn't been an issue. If there are incidents, you know, you can solve those one at a time. But the problem is this is about more than that. This is also about essentially taking a political position and having the law and the public endorse that particular position. And number two, it's really about civil rights and about the protection of all kinds of groups, because the ordinance initially, you know, covered also protection, you know, for people not only in bathrooms, but also from discrimination by vendors who, you know, don't want to serve gay people and so on. So it's much bigger than bathrooms. Bathroom is the sort of easy to remember part of it and the one that politicians can talk about easily, but it's about a lot more. It's anti-discrimination, about a lot of other issues as well.
Okay, let's get some other voices in here, other views. Jim is listening in Dubuque. Jim, how do you see this issue?
Oh, boy, you guys have touched on so many things. I think there's enough time for me to respond.
You give us the top one or two, the top thing on your list, Jim, your top question or concern.
Top one, that was the very first thing that came to mind when this came up, was predatory behavior. Now, we don't have many instances. You do an online search and you will find news stories of girls being assaulted in the girls' bathroom by men from like 2 or 3 years ago. Will this make it easier? There is a case that happened 3 weeks ago down in Florida in a Forever 21 dressing room. Now, those dressing rooms are unisex. They're just basically booths that have half a door in them so you can have some privacy, but you can still and clothing to the clerk and stuff like that. This woman was trying on bathing suits, and she glanced down and noticed the glint off a man's shoe that was poking underneath the wall. Turns out he was wearing a shoe cam and videotaping her or photographing her while she was trying on bikinis. You look online, you can find these shoe cams online. And this guy had a homemade one, which is why it was discovered, because it got to be obvious.
Well, right. That's obviously illegal activity. So what does that have to do with the transgender person, though? It's not really to the point. It's scary, but it's not really the point of this controversy, is it, Jim?
It's not the transgender. It's the people claiming to be transgender and using that. That happened up in Canada, in Ontario, at a women's shelter, where a man claiming to be a transgender was admitted to the woman's shelter, where he proceeded to assault several women there.
Okay.
So
we have plenty of callers here. Let's see if Stefan, Rachel have a response to your concerns there. Stefan?
Well, I mean, there are 1,000 different scenarios in which abuse can take place. My understanding is that, you know, generally these things involve individuals who are not necessarily transgender, but are pretending to be. So you can never police against that, right? I mean, you can never police against a woman coming into a women's bathroom, but it's really a man dressed up as a woman. The only way you can do that is if something happens, like an assault, and then the cops get involved, or, you know, if it's a state where, you know, you are allowed to carry a firearm to protect yourself, you know, somebody's going to go out on a stretcher. So you can't ever solve all of those problems. But I would say that issues like that are best resolved on a case-by-case basis, because assaults occur all the time, and in most cases they don't really involve transgendered people.
Okay, let's talk with Mike in Knoxville before we end this discussion. Mike, what's on your mind in this controversy?
Yeah, my thoughts are, why not just do away with the communal restrooms and have unisex individual restrooms?
Right.
And you could have a baby changing place in there if you needed to. But
right. It's never a problem when it's just a single stall, if you will. That's never the problem. You can have unisex bathrooms. Maybe that's will be the trend.
But none of us are here. You know, all the restrooms at Iowa State are multiple. You know, they have urinals, they have stalls, and so on. And to convert every one of those in North Carolina, or much less in the rest of the country, to just a simple stall, a single stall that anyone can use, I mean, maybe that's the way that we're going to create jobs in this country. You
know? Well, it may be a long-term thing.
Yeah,
remember when everything we bought that was a food product in the store didn't have an extra seal on it.
That's right.
Right? Yeah. And that took years to turn after we were worried about getting contamination into our food. It's a river to river from Iowa Public Radio News. Stefan Schmidt with us, University Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University. Rachel Caulfield of Drake University with us. Let's take one more call on this issue before we move on. Plenty of other politics to talk about. Paul is with us in Des Moines. What point would you like to make? Paul, welcome to the program.
Thank you. The only question I have is, how do you balance the rights of the transgenders with the rights of the religious that don't want to expose themselves or their children to some of this stuff?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Rachel, do you want to take that one?
Well, I think this is part of a broader debate now about religious liberty that's taking place. And one of the things that Governor McQuarrie pointed out in one of his speeches on the topic was, you know, this is a fundamental change of norms that the government is asking us to accept. And that is always the case when you talk about any sort of civil rights issue. You know, integrating the military was about a change of norms. And there were many, many people who were opposed to it, some for religious reasons, as a matter of fact, others for other reasons. The same is true of any single issue that we look at in terms of advancing the rights of a group of people is always going to be about a change of norms. One of the biggest indications that I have seen regarding the changing norms that surround this particular issue is that of those who were polled on the issue, 85% said that they did not know personally anybody who was a transgendered individual. And yet, I think the LGBT movement has moved so far in the past several years that even absent a personal knowledge of the issue or this particular group of people, Americans seem willing to extend rights to those people. It doesn't come without fundamental opposition from some who, for whatever reason, believe that, being gay or lesbian, being transgendered is somehow or another against a religious faith. And so that conflict will continue to exist.
Yes, and there are two different, there are lots of issues on which the laws were changed, but the culture wasn't. I mean, look at the race relations. I mean, I think today race relations are really not in very good shape. And if you look at the numbers of people who are saying, yes, this is fine, it's a little bit more than half of people answering polls. We don't know how many people actually think it's fine. You know, you put these things on referenda and you find that majorities usually turn out against them, you know, as they did with gay marriage in the states that had constitutional amendments to change gay, say that marriage is between a man and a woman. So I think there are all those different levels. One is justice and treating people well. Others is politics. Other is convincing people that new norms are acceptable. And, you know, we're in the middle of a very divided country on this.
Right.
Very divided.
Before we go to break, Stefan, I know you said earlier that this was going to be an issue running right up to November. Rachel, do you believe so? Will this be a significant issue that will, I guess, drive voters out, certain voters, and to whose advantage will that be if they do?
Well, I think it will drive certain voters to the polls, particularly social conservatives. It's an issue that if it is maintained through November, social conservatives who are not excited about Donald Trump in particular, this might be an opportunity to drive those voters to the polls. And so I think we might see it politically into a bigger argument.
But Donald Trump hasn't come out with a traditionally conservative view on this, has he?
No, he has not. And I think that's why social conservatives might be less likely to support him. Other initiatives, and we've seen this in the past, particularly with gay marriage, if other initiatives can be added to the ballot that play on this issue in particular, it might bring more people out to the polls.
Right. And of course, Donald Trump has no problem with changing his position. That's happened already many times. Maybe it'll happen here too. Stefan, do you see this taking the same course as the gay marriage, the same-sex marriage debate that we've had over the last few years here, and how that's played into elections?
Well, I think so. And, you know, the thing is, there is no real conservative running. Donald Trump is not a conservative. He's probably not even a Republican. So, I don't know what his position will be. I doubt if he'll take, you know, much of a position himself on this particular issue, because he has some issues that connect much better with the base of voters that has been coming out for him. Those are issues about trade and illegal immigration.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I think it may fade. You know, it may fade and stay as sort of a regional issue. And certainly Hillary Clinton would be supported more by the LGBTQ community, I think, on that issue, although she hasn't. She speaks about justice and she speaks about treating people well. So I think she's definitely going to benefit from that particular vote.
Stefan Schmidt of Iowa State University, Rachel Caulfield of Drake University with us, our political expertise on hand on this Politics Wednesday. Stay with us as we take a break here short. When we come back, we'll talk about what is being called the fight for the soul of the Republican Party. Republican Party, whose party is it anyway? Paul Ryan's? Donald Trump's? And what about this meeting they're having tomorrow? The issues upon which they disagree. Stefan named a few issues. We'll talk about that when we come back. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. So glad to have you aboard on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, Politics Wednesday. Rachel Caulfield of Drake University, Stefan Schmidt of Iowa State University lending us their expertise as we look at the latest on the political landscape. Tomorrow on this program, we're going to explore, politics aside, what it means to be transgender. So I hope you'll tune in for that. We'll have transgender guests, also researchers at the forefront of understanding how gender expresses itself. Of course, on this show, we've been talking about the politics of that transgender bathroom issue in our first half hour. We're going to put that aside and move on to other political issues. Of course, the latest primaries, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders won the West Virginia Democratic primary yesterday, adding yet more fuel to the argument that he should remain in the race despite badly trailing frontrunner Hillary Clinton in the overall delegate count. It's a win that comes 1 week after Sanders prevailed in Indiana's Democratic primary. That was just last week. 2 weeks after Clinton, though, dominated in a series of contests in the northeast part of the country. Democrats also voting in Nebraska yesterday. But the delegates from that state were all previously assigned from a March caucus. And in that contest, Sanders won 15 pledged delegates compared to 10 for Clinton. Sanders, he says he's in the race until the last vote. Here's part of what he had to say yesterday.
Our message to the Democratic delegates who will be assembling in Philadelphia is, while we may have many disagreements with Secretary Clinton, there is one area we agree, and that is we must defeat Donald Trump.
Rachel Caulfield, is there any conceivable way Sanders could still win the nomination, wrest it away from Hillary Clinton?
I don't think anybody sees a clear path for him to win the Democratic nomination at this point.
Mm-hmm. So is it only a matter of time before a full-throated Sanders endorsement of Clinton happens, do you think, Rachel?
Well, so the Democrats have a tough situation on their hands. Bernie Sanders, I think, has surprised a lot of people, including Bernie Sanders. But what he has shown the party, I think, is that the left flank of the Democratic Party is alive and well. And he's married that with a kind of populism and dissatisfaction with the status quo that is both more liberal than the mainstream Democratic Party and in some cases more conservative than the mainstream Democratic Party. He's getting a lot of those independent voters as well. When you marry those groups together, it's a very potent mix, and it has certainly surprised Hillary Clinton and many of the, you know, the kind of staunch mainstream activists within the party. At this point, a full-throated endorsement of Hillary Clinton, I think, first of all, is necessary, but second of all, is tough. Because a lot of those people who have been attracted to the Sanders campaign are not a natural fit with Hillary Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of Democratic activists right now are really emphasizing the fact that there's so much more similarity and it's going to be so much easier to unite on the Democratic side than on the Republican side. However, you know, if you're a middle or lower class individual from one of these states, and you're feeling like the status quo is failing you in every conceivable way, and Bernie Sanders comes on stage and says, we're going to give you a free college education. And Hillary Clinton comes on stage and says, we're going to give you a debt-free college education. That may seem like a minuscule difference if you're a Democratic activist in Washington, D.C., but to regular folk, that's actually a big difference, and it's something that they understand to be a big difference. They want a systemic change, mm-hmm. and Hillary Clinton doesn't offer that to them.
Okay. Stefan, how do you size up the unifying of the Democratic Party behind a nominee?
Well, I mean, I think Hillary Clinton has other problems with Bernie Sanders, which is that in some of the exit polls, people who vote for Bernie Sanders, when asked, well, if he is not the candidate, who would you vote for? Say Donald Trump. So it's, you know, it's more than just the left of the Democratic Party. It's also people who have lost their jobs. It's coal miners. It's individuals who don't like globalization. It's certainly people who are concerned about illegal immigration. And so, you know, I mean, for the Democrats, there is more than just trying to glue back together the, you know, traditional liberals and the left wing of the party with the mainstream Hillary Clinton one. It's that there is now an awakening in this country, if I may use that phrase, and the Republicans found out what that meant for them. And it meant that it had nothing to do with gluing together any parts of the Republican Party. It had to do with the fact that the Republicans, like the Democrats, had not paid attention to what was going on in coal mining country and in industrial towns that have no jobs. The drug crisis is largely caused by desperation and unemployment. And so there is something stirring in this country that's much bigger than just the two candidates. And I think that's what makes this race so interesting and exciting. And it could be, you know, a watershed election this year that will change a lot of things.
Mm-hmm. Shannon is with us in Davenport. She dialed 1-866-780-9100. Jump on this topic. Shannon, you want to say something here?
Yeah, I mean, I guess my fear is that this is a populist election, and we've only got two populist candidates. Hillary Clinton isn't one of them. So my fear is that if they nominate her, if it were Bernie, I feel like we could have a debate about, okay, we've got two populist candidates. Who has the better ideas? Who has more experience?
Right.
And I worry that, yes, Hillary Clinton is winning. What states is she winning in? Does it do us Democrats any good that she does well in Mississippi? Louisiana. These are not Democratic states anyway.
Mm. Mm. Yeah, interesting point, Shannon, in Davenport. Thank you very much. What about these polls? There's been so many polls taken, the matchup, Trump versus Clinton or Trump versus Sanders. Sanders coming out, both beating Trump at this point. Nate Silver saying, you know, it's hogwash 6 months before the general election to even do sorts of polls like these. But so is it perhaps that Bernie Sanders, I guess the question is, why does Bernie Sanders poll better than Clinton against Trump? Could it be perhaps that Sanders has simply not been the target of years and years of partisan attacks, Rachel Caulfield?
Well, that's part of it. Part of it as well, I think, is what we're all pointing to in different ways, which is that the divide that we're accustomed to looking at is Republican and Democrat. In this election, that divide seems to be falling apart, and instead we're seeing a divide between status quo and not status quo.
Uh-huh.
And when you put two non-status quo candidates up against each other, Bernie Sanders seems to look really good. But when you put Clinton, who is a pretty status quo incrementalist kind of candidate, up against a Donald Trump, then she doesn't fare quite as well. Mm. And I would preface all of that by saying that I think Nate Silver is totally correct on this.
We're way too early, right?
Yeah, I mean, we're way too early, number one. And number two, national polls, simply counting up the number of people who support each candidate, is not how we elect a president.
Right.
So
he says, in his words, it's early. Trump could win. He could also lose in a landslide.
Yeah.
We'll know more in June, he said.
Yeah.
And we don't. He also adds, he doesn't know what this battle between Clinton and Sanders could do, what effect it could have on there. Let's move on here. Plenty to get to before the hour ends, plenty we want to get to as well. It was last Thursday that House Speaker Paul Ryan dropped a bombshell saying he's not ready to say yes to Trump. Trump responded by saying he's not ready to support Ryan's agenda. So they're going to meet tomorrow at the Republican National Committee headquarters on Capitol Hill. Expectations for that, Stefan?
Well, you know, this is a very unusual situation because basically you have a party elite resisting the nominee or the likely nominee of their party, and the nominee resisting the policies of the party, saying you guys lost several elections. I mean, Mitt Romney lost and McCain lost, and back then Dole lost, and so you know, why do I want to go back to the losing positions of the Republican Party at the national level, when I think I'm doing very well in connecting with an unusually broad spectrum of people who normally wouldn't vote for a Republican because they don't like some of the policies. So I think this is going to be a very difficult negotiation at best. Right?
Okay, let's listen to a few words by Corey Lewandowski. He's a Trump's campaign manager, making these comments yesterday on the Fox News program Hannity about the upcoming Trump-Paul Ryan meeting.
You know, I think Mr. Trump and Paul Ryan have a lot in common, and I think those things that they have in common are looking at reducing the budget deficit, you know, making sure we have a balanced budget for the first time since Speaker Gingrich was the Speaker, making sure that we're providing middle-class tax cuts. You know, these are the important things that everyone can agree on in the Republican Party. Smaller government, getting rid of the overzealous government agencies that are burdening our small businesses with their egregious regulations. I think those things are all in line with the Republican values and the Republican Party. I think those things everyone can agree on.
Okay, Trump campaign manager Corey Lewandowski putting a happy face on it, accentuating the positive there.
But that's his job.
That's his job. But Rachel, clue us in. There are a whole list of key issues here that Paul Ryan and Donald Trump, by their statements, just do not agree on.
That's absolutely true. And there are a whole host of issues where Donald Trump just simply doesn't agree with most Republicans.
Right.
A number of Republicans, I think quite surprisingly, have pretty quickly changed their tune on Donald Trump and have been willing to say, you know what? I said I would endorse the Republican candidate. He appears to be the Republican candidate. Let's figure out how to make this work for the sake of party unity. And there have been some who have even been more outspoken than that. And they've said, look, he is appealing to a broad swath of American voters. And maybe he can bring new voters into the party. And maybe that's a good thing. So there's, you know, there's a lot of this is, I think, the first conversation of many in terms of understanding how Donald Trump and the Republican Party are going to coexist, to move together, move forward together. And that's going to be a long series of conversations.
Right. Except we have to remember that, and I know a lot of them personally, there were a lot of Republicans who did not like Mitt Romney. Mitt Romney was a rhino. Mitt Romney was not a movement conservative, a principled conservative. And so the idea that there are people who don't like the front-running candidate is nothing new.
No.
Donald Trump is a little different.
Yeah.
He has a little different personality, but boy, they've had that problem before.
Wait. Take for example, just one example, and how many Republicans are in this position, but one glaring example, Florida Senator Marco Rubio. We know has huge differences with Donald Trump on policy and probably personal differences with him as well, based on the insults that were, launched his way, being repeatedly called Little Marco. He called Trump an embarrassment. Mm-hmm. He said he was fearful at the mm-hmm. prospect of Trump's hand on the nuclear code. Uh-huh. He said he wasn't a Republican. He wasn't a conservative, wow. That he'll lose to Hillary Clinton. Now he supports
right.
Trump. Because he thinks Clinton is worse.
And he may be Trump's vice presidential running mate.
Oh, you believe him? That's a possibility.
It's a possibility. I mean,
yeah.
You know.
Anything's possible.
Yeah,
okay.
Trump is looking, you know.
Yeah.
And
okay.
little Marco doesn't have a job.
That's right. He's not running. He gave up his seat for this opportunity here as well. Let's talk about.
There have been some sources that have indicated that Rubio has been lobbying for the VP spot, which I find remarkable. And then others in the Rubio camp have said that's absolutely not true. He seems to have ruled it out at this point, but. You know, this is one of those election years. Like,
yep.
Who knows what's going to happen
I just
next?
I just got back from a two-day workshop I did in Miami about these elections, and I heard that a lot. I heard it from Miami is, you know, Little Marco's territory, the only place that he did well in the primary. And people said that he is actually interested. And some of the people that have talked to his advisors said, sure, you know, if Donald Trump asks me, you know, I may want him to give me the leadership on Latino issues and on immigration, which Donald Trump won't do. So I guess it's out.
And if anybody's not paying attention to this VP conversation that's kind of going on behind closed doors, the best response so far has been Ben Carson, who, when asked about it, said he would not be interested in the VP slot because he would be distracted, because we all know how much how much the media loves him.
Right. And then you've got another crazy example
right,
there.
Right.
Was not Ben Carson Donald Trump compared him to a child molester?
Yes.
Let's talk about the VP here in the last few minutes here, because Iowa's freshman Senator Joni Ernst is rapidly rising to the top of the list of potential running mates for the presumptive GOP nominee, Donald Trump. Senator John McCain, that was the party's 2008 nominee. Also Iowa Governor Branstad. Senator Chuck Grassley in recent days have floated Ernst as Trump's pick for vice president. Let's listen to Governor Branstad, our governor, in a press conference on Monday. Here he is responding to McCain's remark that Joni Ernst would make a good running mate for Trump, on the reason why she would make a good running mate.
He said he's interested in somebody with military experience, but then he thought having congressional experience would also be maybe even more important. Well, she's got both, and she comes from a key state, and she also, in 2014, came out of nowhere to win a very decisive victory to the Senate.
Okay, so when asked about this, though, Senator Ernst told Politico, quote, "I'm just focusing on Iowa right now," but did not rule out that option. Stefan, do you agree that Joni Ernst might make a good strategic pick for vice president for Trump?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you can't get any better mix of things. She's a woman. She has been very successful in running. She's really not a right-wing kind of faith-based Republican, at least not on the surface. She didn't really run as that. She won all over the state and got all kinds of votes. She's been in the military, and she's from a Midwestern state. Where do you find somebody like that? So, yes, that would be a good pick. I think there are others, of course, but I think Trump probably ought to look at her, because right now this thing is rolling out as an Acela corridor election. You know, everybody that's still left is from the corridor where the Acela high-speed train or slow-speed train
runs. Yeah, you have to clue us Midwesterners
in on
that.
Well, the Acela is the train that runs between Washington, D.C. and Boston and goes through New York, and they're all from within that corridor. They can all get to a railroad station and jump on that train. That's not good, you know. I mean, there should be people on these tickets that come. This is a huge country from other parts of the country. And so Joni Ernst would fit that, I guess. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But, of course, we're thinking about the vice presidential pick in conventional terms. Is there any reason to believe Trump will be conventional about this decision?
The only suggestion that we have firmly from him is that he's looking for somebody who's kind of more of an insider, who understands the process. Joni Ernst is brand new to Washington. Yeah. She's not an insider, at least not yet. She has, a year and a half of legislative experience under her belt, which is, certainly not a disqualifier. But it seems to me that there are some folks with a greater level of institutional knowledge and institutional connections that might be better suited to the post than she would be.
As who?
Well,
I'm dying to know. I'm dying to know. I've got to give a speech in Little Rock, Arkansas later this week, and they're going to ask me who. Who do you think?
I don't know. The one person, the one name that keeps floating around is Newt Gingrich.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
And he obviously has deep institutional networks and deep institutional knowledge. And some historical perspective.
And he shut down the government and didn't get reelected in Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
you know, he's a loser.
Well,
I mean, that's the first thing Hillary is going to do, is to say, you're picking this loser who's lost everything. You know, he shut down the government and,
I think the next thing that Gingrich could then respond with is, hey, together with your husband, I balanced the budget. Right. I mean,
that's the fact
that he actually has a history with the Clintons could, in some ways,
that makes him ineligible.
Well, this could be just a crazy. His addition, I think, could add an entirely new level of craziness to a very crazy political year.
Once you're the presumed nominee, how soon could we expect a vice presidential announcement by Donald Trump? When does that typically happen?
Well, it typically happens at the convention.
Yeah. Okay.
Unless you're Ted Cruz.
A la Sarah Palin.
Right, yeah.
Mm-hmm. That worked out really well for Ted Cruz.
It really did.
Okay,
it was a Hail Mary that didn't work out.
How about this little bit of fringe political news to end our show on a lighter note? Did you see this, Rachel and Stefan? Budweiser Beer's parent company is renaming the flagship beer, Budweiser. They're going to call it America for the duration of the 2016 campaign. And this is a move that Donald Trump says was inspired by his promise to make America great again. Did you hear of this?
Yeah, I haven't heard.
Yeah, I heard. I don't drink Budweiser, but yeah, I heard it. Maybe if they change Stella Artois to America, I'll try it. But I mean, this is a nutty year. It's a crazy year. So I'm not surprised that a company is trying to jump on top of that. You know, obviously, Donald Trump has either damaged or made his brand so famous now that he doesn't have to buy any advertising. I don't know which it's going to be in the end, but okay. it's crazy.
Also, this little footnote here. Today, London's new mayor, Sadiq Khan, promised to help Hillary Clinton defeat Donald Trump in November, insisting the race for the White House was now personal. Khan, the first Muslim leader of any major Western capital, he's a London mayor. He insists he's not a Muslim leader or a Muslim spokesperson, but he said that Trump's proposed ban on anyone of Islamic faith entering the U.S. affected his own family because it would stop his teenage daughters visiting Disneyland.
Well, I heard Hillary Clinton just absolutely screaming and saying, no, no, please don't endorse me. I mean, you think really this is going to be good for Hillary Clinton?
I don't know.
I don't think so. I'm sorry. I don't think so. I think Donald Trump must have paid this guy to endorse Hillary Clinton.
Okay. I heard William Shatner, Captain Kirk, congratulated the new mayor of London by, tweeting him, Khan!
That's right. That's a wonderful year. Wonderful year.
All right. Wonderful to have you both on our show. Stephen Schmidt, University Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University. Rachel Caulfield, Associate Professor in the Department of Political Science, also Associate Director of the Harkin Institute for Public Policy and Citizen Engagement at Drake University. Rachel, Stephen, always loads of insights and fun
you're
on the show. Thank you both so much.
It was fun.
All right. River to River is produced by Claire Roth, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Remember, tomorrow we're going to put politics aside and explore the science of being transgender tomorrow on the program. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.